This just in. We are losing the ability to feed ourselves. It's in the numbers. Right here in the richest nation in the history of the world, 1 in 5, or about 60 million or so, cannot feed themselves, and so must rely on government food aid to survive. But wait, here's where the numbers get really interesting. The greatest percentage of our dependents live in rural areas, which is where, as tradition would have it, we once grew all our food. And so today we pause to ask, why are so many in rural America dependent on others for their food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 978th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there on the shores of Lago di Como who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Aaron, I have a question for you.
I may have an answer.
You may. Why are so many people out there in rural America so much in need of food?
I haven't actually the faintest idea, but I have a feeling we're going to find out.
Well, that's an answer. Well, also with me today, we have a guest co-host in the studio, Shelley Roy. Shelley is the former supervisor for the county of Aspen and that's a pull the microphone up there. Now, that's a pretty rural county, Aspen. It only has like 39 multimillionaires living there, right?
I'd say more like about 120.
120 multimillionaires living there. Okay, good. But it is a fairly rural community, is it not?
Yes, it is. And for up until about the 60s, we were able to grow all our food. Everything was grown in Pickin County, except for, as one of my commissioners used to laugh, they had to get sugar and coffee. But they were able to provide their own vodka via the large potato crop we had.
Wow. And what about tomatoes and stuff like that?
No, tomatoes are a luxury at 8,000 feet.
Way up there in the mountains, yeah. Well, folks, the grandparents' farm never did make much money, but it did produce the best kind of food imaginable. Food from the healthy soil that was fresh, whole, and nutritious. When their children grew up and left the farm, the grandparents sold out to those who wanted to grow government-subsidized sugar beets, and so moved to the little farm town down the road. Today, there is little left of the grandparents' farm but a collapsed barn amidst acres of government-subsidized crops, nor is there much left of the little farm town but boarded-up storefronts and a few residents wondering what to do with time. The reality of rural America is that most of all of our grandparents' farms have been replaced by industrial-scale farms, producing crops you just can't eat without them first being processed in a distant factory. Food crops like corn, soy, wheat, you can't just go out and eat them. You have to process them first. The industrial farms of today have learned how to replace the traditional investment of people's time with that of money, and now use the money to farm with machinery and chemicals. As a consequence, it is possible for one farmer to farm 1,000 acres with no weeds or insect pests. With little need of people's time, our rural communities are left with people in need. And so today we pause to ask, who will feed the rural hungry who can no longer feed themselves? Well, we had a guest scheduled for today. He was John Crabtree with the Center for Rural Affairs, and they put out a press release that captured my attention. The press release said, in essence, here it is right here, SNAP crucial in rural and small town America. That kind of captured my attention, and I got to thinking, you know, people used to pretty much feed themselves out there in the country, but times really have changed. And now almost 15% of the rural households in America are reliant on SNAP, or supplemental nutrition, something like that. I don't know what the full name of it is. Food stamps. 15% of the rural households out there in America rely on food stamps to feed themselves. That's huge. What happened to us that we have become so dependent on government food? Well, that's the subject that we're working today, and hopefully we'll be able to track down our guest who's someplace out in the wilds of Nebraska. But until then, it's you and I and Shelley Roy here. So here we go. Shelley, what about those numbers that one, it's almost like one in five of us is now on food stamps, and the percentage of those on food stamps out in the country exceeds by like 3% those of us in the city. So the country is more dependent on government aid than the city.
Well, yes, and yet that actually makes sense to me, because as we're seeing right here in California, as water becomes an issue, the people who are most being affected are the rural areas who are the agricultural interests. They're being deemed less than important than giving water to the cities.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to money, who has to water? In California, it is said that there's two things about water. One, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting. But two, in California, water flows uphill to money, mm-hmm. which is very true, because that's exactly what it does. It flows uphill, up the Tehachapi Mountains and down into the Los Angeles Basin. So our farmers are pretty much out of luck. But what about out there in the country? And this is a real interesting philosophical notion to me, that in a place where traditionally we were independent, and in that independence very strong, we have now become dependent, and in that dependency, very weak.
What struck me when you were speaking is I was thinking back to, you know, Jefferson originally saw that the foundation of America would be the rural farmers, and that was one of the reasons they had such the desire to push forward, because they saw the opportunity for all the people in America to have a stake in the land and to be independent. And yeah, but that all starts to fall apart. You know, the Grange Wars were about that model wasn't working. The money was already shifting to the East. And in fact, just as a little tidbit, Madison and Jefferson die practically bankrupt because the farming model is already crumbling.
Mm-hmm. So, George Washington did pretty good.
George Washington did pretty good. In fact, I think he even figured he was able to use his surveying information to acquire more and more Western lands. And mm-hmm. what they were doing, they weren't rotating. You know, we can get into it. It's a long subject. But going to your question that struck me is, in the, you know, after the Dust Bowl, the government steps in, and because we are having so many of the farmers going bankrupt, and, you know, all of those wonderful Simon LeGrew stories,
right.
Very visual period of what was happening, government steps in and starts doing the subsidies and the whatnot to keep the farmers. Well, what happens is, as you said, money flows uphill, and what we begin to see is the small farmer is bought out by the money, who now sees Uncle Sam as their partner and not Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. And Mother Nature is a very fickle partner for the rural farmers. So we transferred to being a corporate farming versus Jefferson's original vision of an agricultural country.
It's interesting that exact situation has played out on my grandparents' farm, where their farm, 360 irrigated acres up in Montana, was truly self-sufficient. And in almost all respects, I mean, they had to go into town once in a while, buy coffee or something like that, but they always had something to exchange for that coffee, and were truly independent. And the farm never did make much cash, but it made great people.
People and a good life.
And a good life.
It was a good life.
And then,
hard, but good.
But then, you know, the kids grew up, and the kids didn't want that good life. They wanted the glitz of the city, and so moved into town, like so many other young people did. And so the grandparents were really left with no alternative but to sell the farm to the those who wanted to grow government-subsidized sugar beets. And so they had to move into town, and the farm is now a government-subsidized plantation with no people on it. And there we are, folks. That is the subject today. Who's going to feed the rural hungry when government runs out of money? Who's going to be left standing when it all comes tumbling down, if it will? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, we're hunting for John Crabtree from the Center for Rural Affairs. He's out there running around somewhere in Nebraska, but we'll track him down. And we have you as well. Question is today, why are so many out there in the rural parts of America so hungry, and who is going to feed them? Do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, today we're not talking with John Crabtree, the Center for Rural Affairs. He got lost someplace in the great state of Nebraska. Maybe he's out wandering around in one of those forever cornfields, you know, that go on for like 10,000 acres and there's nothing but corn. And John Crabtree from the Center for Rural Affairs is lost out in the middle of one of those cornfields. And the corn is like 8 feet tall, so he can't find his way out, and he doesn't know which end is up.
Maybe that's the ultimate maze,
yeah. At any rate, we're talking about rural hungry, and oh my goodness, why is it that the greatest percentage of our hunger here in the most wealthy nation in the world lives in the countryside, where traditionally, at least, we grew all of our food? Well, of course, we no longer grow food out there. We grow kind of commodities like corn and soy and wheat, things that you can't just eat. You have to take them into town to a big factory, and you have to process them. You know, soy, for example, has to undergo such an incredible process to make it edible that if you knew what that process was, you probably wouldn't want to eat it. That's the extent of it. But that's what it is out there. So we no longer really grow the kind of foods that we eat. We grow the kind of foods that you have to put through a factory. And then what comes out the other end in a package is the food that we eat.
And Michael, you're touching on a couple things. Going back, food. Let me just real quick.
This would be Shelley Roy, our guest fill-in host today.
Who is going to be silent today? But I got to thinking when you were talking. My dad's family were from a small town in Louisiana, and they were actually, I learned on a recent visit, one of the wealthier people in town because they had enough land in town where Mama and Papa could grow almost all the food that was served at the table, and they had 5 children. And they had a cow, they made their own milk, their own cheese, they grew all of their own foods and vegetables there. And what I'm hearing you say, Michael, and I'm agreeing, is we have moved from people being self-sufficient, growing their own food on their own parcels. Having the know-how. My mom grows roses and grass. And we don't have, in fact, it's somewhere, I'm wondering when it became uncouth and low class to have a vegetable farm in your front yard. go on.
No, that's exactly the thread that I'm trying to pick up here. Why is it that those who live out in the country where there is access to a lot of land are so hungry, when at one time we all knew how to feed ourselves without anybody's help outside? And furthermore, if what happens, where is all of this government aid taking us as we become increasingly more reliant on the government to feed us? Holy smokes, folks, 15% of the households in the countryside now rely on government food. And as this percentage keeps growing, and it is growing, where is that going to take us down the road? Who is going to be there to feed us when we all become reliant on somebody else to feed us?
Well, here's another big cultural jump. Again, going back to one small case. In your data here, it's the elderly and the children who are most on the food stamps. I guess the assumption is they aren't out working, so therefore they need help, because food no longer is in your backyard. It's something you have to get money for to get. So going to my thought, thinking back on my dad and the kids, the kids were the workers on the family plot, and my grandmother, the mother, was the director. You know, George. George, it's your day to milk the cow. And by the way, you can earn. I can remember my dad was so excited when his older brother went off to college, and he got the job for 50 cents a week milking the neighbor's cow. So the kids were your employees in a neighborhood, and our kids now, they don't know how to do anything.
Well, and I don't think they're allowed to do anything.
I think there is a law. You're not allowed to work till you're 17 and a half. You know, an hour before you can vote, you're allowed to work.
There you go. And, you know, in thinking back to the grandparents' farm, you know, we started spending our summers there, my brother and I, when we were very, very young. You know, get the kids out of the house, send them to the farm, please. And so there we were, you know, 5- and 6-year-olds on the farm.
Yeah.
But you were given work to do right away.
Collecting eggs, something.
Well, it wasn't just little work to do. It was important work to do. I think I drove my first tractor at the age of 6. I mean, Grandpa put me up on that thing, and I remember it this very clearly. He put it into gear, and he said, "I'll meet you at the other end of the field," you know, and the little kid on top of a tractor. And of course, if you were to do something like that today, you would be arrested and thrown in prison for
child abuse
or something like that. But as a consequence of not allowing our children the opportunity to work, and for not having the know-how of the grandparents there to superintend, then we become increasingly more dependent all along on somebody else to feed us. So who is that that's out there feeding us? What do you think out there? We're in need of your calls today because our guest is lost in a cornfield in Nebraska. Our phone number is today 831-479-1080 and 800-624-2665. The question is, why are so many in rural America so dependent on others for their food? What happens as with our efforts to feed the rural poor? Are we helping them by feeding them? Or are we taking away from their ability to figure out how to make it on their own?
And is this a situation in rural America, the canary in the mine for the rest of us?
Ooh. And is what's happening in rural America the canary in the mine for what's happening to us in the city? They're out in the country, pretty close to 15% of the households are on food stamps. Here in the city, it's like 12%. But are we heading that way too? That more and more and more of us are going to be reliant and without the means of taking care of ourselves? And what happens to us when we no longer can take care of ourselves? What happens to our minds when we need somebody else to take care of us.
And I want to just go back, because one of the things that you brought up something brilliant on children. You felt so important. You were necessary to that farm. Children today are not given the gift of thinking they're necessary and that they're important and that they have a value. You know, they're treated more like pets that are indulged and are a bit of a nuisance at times. But they do not have that sense growing up that I am integral to the success of those around me and to my parents and my grandparents, and that my very existence can bring value.
I'm not important.
No, I'm not important. I'm catered. I'm in the way. They put a headphone on me and hook me up to a TV or a computer. I have no, well, in fact, it's interesting. My mind's jumping around, but I think of Matrix. The movie Matrix shows the children that their importance is nothing more than being warm bodies to keep the machines that operate the world moving. By taking children off the farm, have we put them into a tube on the Matrix?
Wow. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're playing around with this notion that we are becoming increasingly more dependent upon others to feed ourselves. You can see the percentage increasing dramatically out in the rural America, where 15% of us now rely on government food programs like SNAP or supplement or food stamps. And in the cities, 12% of us or so are now reliant on food stamps. The Center for Rural Affairs says food stamps are very important in rural America. Well, obviously that's true, because people cannot feed themselves out there anymore. What can we do to help those out there help themselves? Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're looking out into the countryside and we're scratching our head over the fact that we're becoming increasingly less independent. We're losing our ability, and of course, if it's going to start anywhere, it's going to start with our ability to feed ourselves. And more and more and more people out there in rural America are becoming dependent on the government food aid programs like SNAP, which used to be called food stamps. 15% of the households in rural America now rely on government for food assistance. Somewhere that's about 3% more than in the city. So out there in the country where we used to grow all of our own food to feed the cities, we no longer have that anymore. And a lot of it has to do with the changing nature of agriculture, where we used to, you know, have farms that grew lots of different kinds of food and kind of were very self-sufficient, probably a lot like the Amish are today. I guess when I think of my grandparents' farm, I think of kind of like they were secular Amish when it got right down to it, because they lived so much like the Amish. Though they did have, you know, mechanical devices that ran on hydrocarbons. Otherwise, they were pretty much like the Amish. They were religious people. They were faithful to the earth. Their soil was every bit as biodynamic as anything the biodynamic community of today would invent. And the foods that came from that soil were whole. And very, very fresh. You can still be plucking the chicken off the feathers off the fried chicken almost, you know. And, of course, very nutritious. But those farms are pretty much gone. And today we're left with those industrial-scale farms that produce thousands of acres of commodities that you can't really eat until they've been taken into a factory and processed into something that comes out in packages that you buy at the supermarket. And so we're now pretty much reliant on those foods. And if you're out in the country, that's what you're stuck buying is foods that come in packages in supermarkets. Because somehow we've lost the ability out there in the country, or losing it, to have our own gardens and our own ways of producing food. So the question today is, and this is for you out there because our guest is lost in a cornfield in Nebraska someplace, is why are so many out there so hungry for help in feeding themselves? What on earth is going to happen as we continue to feed more and more and more of them? Where is this going to take us, this notion that we can feed our way out of hunger? Where is that going to take us? And finally, what is the end game in all of this? Can we end hunger by feeding people? I don't know. Those are things I'm scratching my head about. And fortunately, I have Shelley Roy here with me to help scratch my head and scratch hers. Shelley is a politician, a former politician. She was the county supervisor for what county? Pierce County?
Pitkin County.
What?
Pitkin.
Pitkin County.
And here's a bit of trivia.
Aspen, Colorado.
Pitkin County came into being because Aspen people, like Santa Cruz people, were always very independent. And they didn't like that their county seat, you know, back in the West, they would just draw lines for states and counties
with
no rhyme or reason to that there happened
big
to be mountains and rivers blocking these things. So in Pitkin County, our county seat, it was only 18 miles away as the crow flies, but 2 days to drive to it. So we decided back in 1870 we were going to form our own county, and we did the politically correct thing. We offered to name it after the then governor of Colorado. So he, of course, immediately signed on to letting us have our own county and our own county seat right there in the middle of it.
Uh-huh. So there it is. So, but, you know, that's an independent country, too. You know, mountain folk tend to be very independent.
You have to be. Because you're a long way from a food source.
And country people have always been very independent people, too. But can you be very independent if you can't feed yourself?
No, you can't. And by the way, we lost a caller accidentally here. He was from Corralitos, and I would have loved to have heard from him because Corralitos is one of your agricultural areas.
Yeah, we have
it
a
appears
lot of
to
agriculture.
Be very independent. I mean, I'd only been here a week, and I heard about the great Corralitos market with the best sausage for miles.
So, but going back to that question, and I'd like to explore it for a little bit, can we be independent when we're reliant upon somebody else to feed us?
Never. In the long run, you become vulnerable. And we're seeing it.
What do you mean in the long run? It would seem to be in the very short run. If you can't feed yourself, you're...
Well, it's actually been the million-dollar question since man began. We've been trying to figure out how to feed ourselves and to be woolly dependent. And as I alluded earlier, Mother Nature is not only always a good partner for us. She, you know, sometimes she denies you rains for, you know, 3 years.
Well, and thus we get to the whole notion of charity and feeding
the
hungry.
Well, actually, where we got to, that's one of the things globalization has done very successfully, is you are now not as vulnerable as a human race on the planet to what is happening in a particular area. So California might be having a drought, but Chile is still getting water. In fact, who was under water? The East Coast, were they flooding?
Sure, they're having a bumper crop of grains in the East Coast. Well, let me challenge you with that notion. Let's say we have a drought in Africa. We always seem to have a drought in Africa, right?
Well, there we are. There's the extreme here. Right?
So what we do is we load up big, huge tanker ships here in the United States filled with grain, and we take it down to Africa, and we dump it on the port and say, here's your grain, feed the hungry. Well,
yes.
What happens to local agriculture when you take a surplus from here and dump it on the dock there?
They can't get the money. It's five times more expensive in a drought to produce the food. And then you underwrite the cost of what they could sell it for. So they probably go out of business because they can't get top dollar during a drought period.
Okay. Then what happens when they go out of business?
They become more reliant on the United States to ship food over.
Okay. How does that differ than what's happening in the heartland of America. Is there a difference there?
There's no difference at all. In fact, to your earlier point, where there were not food stamps, those children would be learning under grandma's tutelage how to grow some food in the backyard.
Uh-oh. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're looking for your calls and comments today. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1088. We're going to feed the hungry in the heartland of our country. But what happens when we do? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phones and join us. We'd love to hear from you. Who will feed the hungry when the hungry can no longer feed themselves? And what happens when we do feed the hungry? Who will teach them then how to grow their own food? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080.
But that didn't happen.
The numbers are in, and they tell us that right here in the richest nation in the history of the world, one in five, or about 60 million, can no longer feed themselves and so must rely on government food aid to survive. And here's where the numbers get really interesting. The greatest percentage of our dependents live in rural areas, which is where, as tradition would have it, we once grew all of our food. And so today we pause to ask, who's going to feed those hungry? Well, of course, our government is going to feed them. And it now feeds 15% of the rural households in the United States of America with supplemental food aid. It's called SNAP programs. The EBT cards, you go to the grocery store these days and the little machine asks you how you would like to pay with your credit card, your debit card, your EBT card. And there's so many of us now that are living on supplemental food aid. And we're just asking today where this is going to take us down the road as we continue down this road of feeding the hungry. And where is it going to take us, ladies and gentlemen? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, Shelley, you told this story about elk.
Yeah, well, he was gone.
And you can't just tell good stories off the air. You have to tell them on the air.
Well, one of the things a key word you just said is so many of us. In Picking County, we have an
elk. It's Aspen, Colorado.
Aspen, Colorado. We have an elks club, and within the environmental community, we had a couple really bad winters, and the elk were starving, and you were seeing them all over. So there were there was help offered for the elk, and they got through that winter. We didn't lose any elk.
So you've fed them hay.
Yep, they got fed. And well, the problem with elk are they're very large and they're very hungry. And now they were a whole bunch of elk. We hadn't had a die off that winter, and they began to eat everything. And what happened is all the other critters started dying. The deer started dying, all of the smaller creatures, because the damn elk were eating they were denuding the countryside. And it gets back to, there's so many of us. If food is always available, the natural human instinct when you're starving, in fact, I think the body actually doesn't produce young when it's starving, because we're mucking with that natural phenomena in the human to not have offspring during periods of low food. I wonder how much that is the cause of the population explosion that we have right now. We are not allowing natural attrition to occur in our population.
Whenever you subsidize something, you distort its value.
Oh, God, in spades.
You know, so if you decide you want to grow sugar beets, all of a sudden sugar beets become worth much more than they would otherwise be worth.
You started it with follow the money, flow to the money. You put money into something, that's where it goes. And it's curious, are we putting too much money into growing the human population?
Well,
accidentally, because we don't like to see any, we didn't like seeing the elk hurt. And because we didn't want to see pain around us, we caused more pain.
Well, then the question becomes, how can we teach dependent or self-sufficiency in rural America by funding dependency?
We're funding dependency, yes. And, you know, one of the things, I don't know how you undo something. It's got to come from the culture outward. You know, desperation does cause people to learn to grow things real quick. I think if you were starving, you would figure
it out. When you're hungry, you go out and take care of yourself. You know, you have to get a job. You have to, plant a garden. You have to take care of yourself.
Since we're getting near the end of the show, I was going to, because I don't know how we make that transition. Something that happened recently, I went to the Seascape Farmers Market, and one of the vendors there is a young family who own something small, like 2 acres, but they decided that they wanted to do exactly what you and I are talking about today. They wanted their children to understand where food comes from. Their children are very young. I think the girl was like 10 and the baby's 2. They are purposely and planning. They have a small family farm. The kids work, family members work on it, and they sell their excess produce at the farmer's market. Only on 2 acres of land, or was it an acre? It was a small mm-hmm. parcel. And, you know, what I'm seeing is in our young, my son is starting to understand this, that perhaps the program should be directed towards, and the way our governments think, should be directed towards us. All of us are letting our lawns die. How do we have those lawns replaced with small family plots of vegetables? How does that become what's cool in Santa Cruz?
And something you just said also struck me is because rural people, in my memory, though very independent, were also interdependent.
Oh, yes.
If I had excess milk and you had excess eggs, we traded.
Absolutely.
Right? And in that...
You got potatoes, I have yeast, we can have vodka.
There you go. But in that trading back and forth, we developed a cohesive community. Now, when there no longer is that trading back and forth, how does that strengthen the community? I guess that's the question. Folks, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. How are we going to rebuild rural America by subsidizing hunger or subsidizing the feeding of the hungry? And is there a difference there? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, we have so few minutes left, but so much to think about. And one of the biggest questions that is left in my mind after this discussion, really, is can we end hunger in rural America by subsidizing the hungry in rural America? Can we encourage an independent economy in rural America by encouraging that dependency on government food aid? What do you think out there? It's a tough one, because when we ask that question, we're wondering about feeding the hungry and where it's going to take us. We do want to feed the hungry. We want to feed people who are in temporary need. But when we set up a system that guarantees this need for as long as you can think, well, how on earth are we going to foster independence and community? Shelley, you got any ideas? Help me out here.
Well, I'm sorry. You know, my issues have become water and what immediate, mm-hmm. and it's not rural because right now I don't know that much about rural America, frankly.
But you do know.
But I do know, like, for instance, one of the things that struck me is that what one of the SoCal Water Board meetings, in fact, on 2 of them, people who have planted fruit trees on their properties where they are in front of the board pleading for additional water for their fruit trees. And as you and I were off the air talking, I said, well, you know, we're giving 60 gallons per person or 75 gallons per person.
Out here in California, folks, it's very, very dry. And we're fighting over gallons of water per day to keep our fruit trees and whatnot alive.
Well, we've chosen the people over the fruit trees.
Yeah. And, well, again, this, to me, is a temporary situation that we're trying to come to grips with. We're in, you know, we're in a drought. But out in the rural country, it's not really a temporary situation that we're looking at. It's a permanent situation, a situation that's been going on for decades now, wherein we no longer, rural people are out there, but they're no longer growing the kinds of food we eat. They're growing commodities that must be processed into packaged foods. And so how do we bring back an independent rural economy? Is it going to be possible by subsidizing people really to not take care of themselves or not figure out a way to take care of themselves? Can we end hunger by feeding the hungry all the time, by subsidizing them, by keeping them going? Or is there another way? Is there a way to help them figure out how to help themselves? I'm probably going to be in a lot of trouble for asking this question, aren't I, Shelley?
I'm looking at you going, oh boy, Michael, it's a good thing we're almost out of time.
Okay. It's a good thing we're almost out of time. Well, that probably explains why John Crabtree, who was with the Center for Rural Affairs, did not join us today. He probably thought, I know where these guys are going to ask these questions, and my job is to make sure everybody in rural America has food stamps, and I'm not going to talk with them, so heck with them. So, but there it is, folks. I asked the question, what do you think? You can always join us on the food chain page at metrofarm.com. The idea is to figure out a way to help America help itself. And is feeding the hungry or subsidizing them forever the way? I don't know. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, Michael Olson, third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
Ciao.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.